Now, that's in the Greek-speaking sphere. Over in the West, the most significant figure is probably Cyprian. And it's Cyprian I've chosen to look at. Yeah, origins of the East. He's Alexandria, Greek-speaking. Cyprian, again, North Africa. What is amazing in the light of subsequent history is how North Africa is such a repository for significant theology in this early period, and today it's a wasteland, which is it's a salutary reminder that when churches depart from the faith, the Lord could remove their lamps. But that's many centuries down the road. Now, with Cyprian, what I'd like to do before I even get into looking in detail at this letter to Donatus, which is a letter which recounts his conversion, what I'd like to do is say a little bit about the third century in terms of its politics. And I'm going to begin with chapter 6, which is page 12 there. So as I said, I've given you a number of things here. I've given you a modern biographical sketch of Cyprian. I've given you his letter to Donatus. I've given you the Acts of Cyprian, which records his martyrdom, and then this biographical sketch, an early biography of Cyprian. Now, let me begin there with chapter 6. And he's been talking about God's goodness to him as an unbeliever and in bringing him to faith in Christ. And he says these words: "In order that the characteristics of the divine munificence, that is, divine goodness, may shine forth when the truth has been revealed, I shall give you light to recognize it. By wiping away the cloud of evil, I shall reveal the darkness of a hidden world. For a little, consider that you are being transported to the loftiest peak of a high mountain, that from this you are viewing the appearance of things that lie below you. And with your eyes directed in different directions, you yourself, free from earthly contacts, gaze upon the turmoils of the world. Presently, you will also have pity on the world, and taking account of yourself and with more gratitude to God, you will rejoice with greater joy that you have escaped from it. Observe the roads blocked by robbers, the seas beset by pirates, wars spread everywhere with the bloody horrors of camps. The world is soaked with mutual blood. And when individuals commit homicide, it is a crime. It's called a virtue when it is done in the name of the state. Impunity is inquired for crimes, not reason by innocence, by reason of innocence, but by the magnitude of the cruelty." Now, this statement could not have been made 100 years before. This statement is made around 242, 243, just after, not long after Cyprian's conversion. I'll talk about Cyprian's life after I've gone through the larger picture of the third century, because that larger picture is vital to understanding Constantine, and thus I'm kind of building here for what I want to talk about in the next lectures. Now, this statement could not have been made, as I said, 70 years earlier, even 60 years earlier. If you go back to 180. He couldn't have made this statement. And that is because between the reign of Augustus Caesar, who reigned from 27 BC to 14 AD, and if you want, you can go back and look at the emperors there on that sheet. Remember the list of emperors right at the beginning. Let's go back and look at that sheet so I can more easily show you. Right at the beginning of the sheet, there are a couple of pages of permissions, and then the map, and then now the table of emperors. Between the reign of Augustus Caesar, who dies in 14 AD, and Marcus Aurelius, who dies in 180, that was really a period, nearly 200 years, of what we call the Pax Romana, The Romans called it that. Roman peace. Now, it was a Roman peace bought at the price of significant bloodshed and conquest of various nations in the Mediterranean world. But apart from one brief period, namely at the end of the reign of Nero, you'll notice that Nero killed himself in 68. Well, it doesn't say that, but he did. And he is succeeded by three others, Galba, Otho, Vitellius. They all are emperors in the same years. And that's because there was a year of civil war in which various legions tried to promote their commanders to the imperial throne. And these guys were either bumped off by the Praetorian Guard, murdered, or they were killed in battle until one of them, Vespasian, emerged as the victor. Vespasian is the emperor during which time Jerusalem is sacked and taken. Now, apart from that period of time, there was a peaceful, fairly peaceful succession of power, especially from Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. During that period of time, Nerva was an old man when he became emperor. He adopted Trajan, who was a Spaniard, who adopted Hadrian, who was another Spaniard. Antoninus Pius came from a very old Roman family, likewise Marcus Aurelius. Hadrian adopted Antoninus Pius, and Antoninus Pius adopted Marcus Aurelius. And in those days, adoption meant that you not only inherited the wealth and debts of whoever adopted you, but you also inherited their position in society. That is absolutely critical. And I'll remind you of that later when we get to Leo the Great. Now, with Marcus Aurelius spent most of his latter years campaigning against the Germans in Germania. And it was a forerunner or a prognostication of the future, because during the 3rd century, you'll notice that in the century between Nerva, 96, and the death of Marcus Aurelius, you basically have five emperors: Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. Lucius Verus was a co-emperor with Marcus Aurelius. Once you move into the 3rd century, though, if you go, for instance, let's say you go from Elagabalus. Elagabalus was a nutcase who worshipped a meteorite, which actually he brought from Asia Minor, a meteorite that had fallen on a part of Asia Minor. Somehow he came across it, declared that it was a god, brought it to Rome, demanded everybody in Rome worship this thing, and eventually he was murdered. But not before he caused great ridicule upon the office of emperor. If you go from Elagabalus, go all the way down. Now, see, what we've done, in 100 years from Nerva, pretty well 100 years from Nerva to Marcus Aurelius, you've got five emperors. You go from Elagabalus to Diocletian, that's 60 years, that's 70 years, roughly, from Elagabalus to Diocletian. Look at the number of emperors you got. You've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. 24 emperors in about 75 years, about 3 years per emperor. Of those 24 emperors, only two died peacefully. The rest died violently. They were either murdered or they were killed on the battlefield. Decius is killed on the battlefield, for instance, and we'll talk about him in a minute. Valerian, who was there a couple ones after Decius, from 253 to 260, he was actually captured in battle by the Persians, and the Persian king took him. I'm not sure if he counts whether he died violently or peacefully, because he was in a Persian prison. He died in the Persian prison, and then the Persian king had him stuffed, you know, like a taxidermy, you know, when you stuff an animal and put it on display. Well, he had the emperor stuffed and stuck in a corner of the royal palace, the main audience chamber. So when dignitaries came to visit him, he says, well, we're not afraid of Rome. There's the last Roman emperor, and that's what we did with him. And In other words, what you've got there, you've got a long tail of violence when it comes to the heart of the government. And that reflects the larger picture. During the third century, there is a significant breakdown in terms of Roman military rule. And part of that breakdown has to do with the inability of the Roman Empire now to safeguard its borders. It had two main problems. If you flip back a page, you'll now have the map. The two main problems come from, first of all, east of the Euphrates River, the Persian Empire. They are known as the Sassanids. And they were a major thorn in the side of the Romans. And the border there, because a lot of that area is desert, the border was very fluid. It was not always clear who owned what in this period. The other major area problem is Germania. And Germania is north and east of the Rhine. It's not specified there. But basically, the Romans, where they could, they built fortifications. In, for instance, Britain, they built Hadrian's Wall in northern England to control, basically to prevent the incursion of the Picts and the Scots down into their province. In North Africa, they had the benefit of the Sahara, which was not as big as it is now. Part of the reason why it grew over the years was Roman agricultural practices. The Romans liked goats, and goats are dreadful animals in one sense. Goats will basically eat, but they're not like sheep or cows, which only eat the surface, the top vegetation. Goats will eat right down, eat the roots. And you got significant numbers of goats imported into an area that normally didn't have them. It's going to uproot a lot of the vegetation and further the way for a desertizing or the growth of the desert. And Roman agricultural practices are believed to have been one of the reasons for the growth of the Sahara. But basically, in the North Africa, they didn't have to worry about fortifications. The Sahara was big enough to keep out sub-Saharan tribes. In the east was a problem. The Romans did have various forts, but there was a fluidity in the border. In Europe proper, they had two great rivers that, in their experience, were deep, wide, fast-flowing, had never, ever frozen. The Rhine, running northwest, north-south, rather, coming out of the Alps, flowing north into the North Sea, and then the Danube, also coming out of the Alps and flowing all the way down into the Black Sea. The only area of land that they ever had on the other side of those rivers was Dacia. And Dacia basically is a block of land just north of the Danube as it comes into the Black Sea, and that's Romania. And that's why Romanian is a Romance language. And if you ever hear Romanian, it sounds like Italian. And because it's Latin base, very unusual in that part of the world where everything else is Slavic. But that's because of the Roman occupation. Romans occupied Dacia under Trajan. They held it for about 200 years. But during the 3rd century, there were significant incursions, especially across the Rhine, where German cavalry would cross on boats, raiding into the heart of Roman territories. We know something of the raids, both by written records, also by archaeological finds. Sometimes the areas they would attack, because they were cavalry, light, fast-moving, they were not there to besiege cities. They wanted to plunder, get something, and get back. And we know something because they would generally attack significant-sized suburban villas outside of city walls, outside of fortifications. And sometimes the owners, hearing that the barbarians were coming, would hide their wealth. And either they were killed and couldn't go back for it, or they forgot where they hid it. And thus they have found hordes of coins. Archaeologists have found hordes of coins stretching from the border here with Rhine all the way into Hispania. And we can know when they're dated because of the emperor's image. So we have an idea of when they were hidden. And during this period, then, there are significant military incursions. And you've got then the breakdown of the Roman ability to guard her frontiers. The Roman army, generally armies are fairly conservative. The Roman army was very slow to change. And at the heart of the Roman army was the foot soldier, the legion, not cavalry. And thus, along the Rhine River, what the Romans had done is every 30 or 40 miles they had a fort. And in between that, they would have watchtowers, which would signal barbarian incursions. But by the time a signal would get to a fort, the soldiers get ready, march out, the barbarians are long gone. And the way forward for the Romans will be to switch to significant numbers of cavalry in their army, but that's a later story. So you have military problems in terms of defense. Internally, things are breaking down as well. The whole issue of the successful transfer of power. How do you do it? In the second century, it worked by the adoption of very capable individuals. All of those men, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius, are all remarkably capable individuals. In the third century, you have a long list of megalomaniacs, incompetent individuals, vicious, ambitious generals who have no concern for the public welfare or society, who simply want power for power's sake. And so not only do you have the barbarian incursions, you also have civil war, which gives you an idea as to why you've got all those various emperors, many of them being slain on the battlefield or being murdered. And so that's a military issue. Not surprisingly, you've got other issues that are related to it. You have economic issues. There is massive inflation during the third century. We know that because the coins that have been found, they are no longer, they purport to be equivalent to silver and gold coins that were used in the time of Augustus Caesar, but they are no longer of the same quality of silver, or do they contain the same amount of silver? And what a lot of the coins will have is a significant copper interior with a silver glaze. And there's been a devaluation of money. For instance, a solidus, which was a gold coin, no longer, it was probably about 70% less of its value in the third century than it had been during the first century. So there's devaluation of coinage, which reflects economic problems. There is rampant inflation during the third century. There is a breakdown of Roman technology. Buildings are not being built. Again, we know that because archaeologists can date a lot of Roman buildings because usually they would put very sculpted friezes on them that depict contemporary events. And there's very few buildings being built in this period of time. When they are being built, what is being done is previous buildings are being vandalized. That is, Romans would go, say, an arch, a triumphal arch built, say, during the reign of Titus. And you've got an arch, one of these emperors during this period wants to build an arch. He doesn't have the money to employ gifted sculptors, so he goes to Titus's arch and he strips off some of the stuff and puts it on his own. And that also is indicative of a breakdown of the transmission of various technical arts in terms of the whole area of material arts, like sculpture. And so you've got then a situation in which there is a failure of defense, political breakdown within the empire, rampant economic inflation, and certain things started to take place that had not been heard of for centuries. For instance, the Mediterranean had been free from pirates since the time of Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar died in 44 BC. So about 250 years later, suddenly pirates start to emerge on the Mediterranean. And that's because of the breakdown of the ability of the Roman Navy to police the waters of the Mediterranean. And the reason why Caesar had scoured the Mediterranean was he was actually captured at one point by pirates who ransomed him. Caesar told them not to ransom him. He said, "You better kill me, because if you ransom me and I live, I'm going to come back and destroy you." And pirates didn't listen. They ransomed him, and he was true to his word and came back and destroyed all piracy in the Mediterranean. But one of the evidences of the breakdown of Roman rule internally was the emergence of piracy. And that's why when he says there, notice, Cyprian says in the second to last sentence we just read, "Observe the roads blocked by robbers, seas beset by pirates." He's talking about the Mediterranean. That's the only sea he knows, and the various parts, the Adriatic, the Aegean. But that's the sea he's talking about. And he's talking about the bloody horrors of camps, the world soaked with mutual blood. And it is a vivid depiction of the mid-3rd century, which could not have been said 60 to 80, even 100 years earlier. Now, it is in this context, and I've spent some time going through that because I think it serves as a backdrop to the time of Cyprian. The 3rd century is a century in which there is significant growth of the church. And one of the reasons for that is I think that God uses, providentially uses, times of upheaval, political, economic chaos, to draw people to Christ, to break them off of their own natural supports in a culture. And this may well be a factor in Cyprian's own conversion, although there are other things that he mentions that are just as equally important. And the other reason why I've gone into this trouble of this is because I want to prepare the ground for looking at Constantine. And there is one of the great historical questions is, why did the Roman Empire not fall in the 3rd century? It should have fallen. It did not. Why? And we'll see the answers to that when we look at Constantine. Now, Cyprian. What we know of Cyprian is that he is born around the year 200. Again, that is a guess, a guesstimate. Pontius could have told us all kinds of details about Cyprian's life. He had known Cyprian a long time. He knew Cyprian fairly well. But he actually tells us at the beginning of his biography, he tells us that what a man did before his conversion is of no value. And so he doesn't tell us a thing. Which theologically is true. But for a historian, it's very frustrating. So we know very, very little about Cyprian prior to his conversion. What we do know are a number of things that are very important. First of all, he was a rhetorician. In the Roman Empire, this discipline, rhetoric, was the highest discipline that a man could aspire to. And the Roman world was a world in which the ability to speak publicly was highly prized. The Romans had inherited from the Greeks a great emphasis on training individuals to speak publicly. In the Greek world, there had been a reason for this. In Greek culture, like for instance Athens was a democracy, and it was a participatory democracy, which is very dissimilar in many respects from our Western democracies today. In Athens, Athens was a town of about 10,000 at its height, maybe 12. Actually, probably a bit bigger than that. It was probably about 10,000. Male citizens over the age of 18 who are free. Every one of them was entitled to go to the ecclesia, the assembly, which ran the city. And everybody could vote. Everybody could speak their mind. And the ability to speak one's mind in the ecclesia was known as parousia. You know that word, boldness. That was a description of the ability and the freedom that an individual had to get up in the assembly and say anything about anything that the city was contemplating. And it was a participatory democracy that was unheard of in the ancient world. And a number of Greek cities had this sort of political structure. And in that context, if you had the ability to speak well, sway people, use imagery, put together arguments, develop points, that would give you significant influence in the assembly. And so rhetoric was the teaching of people how to speak well, similar to some degree as homiletics is today. The Romans inherited that. Theirs was not a participatory democracy. It was a dictatorship. But nonetheless, there had persisted this whole culture of training young men in their 20s to be rhetoricians, to be able to speak very well. And Cyprian was a rhetorician. He was a teacher of rhetoric, which really in our equivalent is like a PhD who teaches postgraduate studies. Very, very highly valued position. He also appears to be in the aristocratic class, and probably the senatorial class, as we'll see in a minute. We know that from a couple of things. One is some statements he makes about himself. The other statement is that when he was converted, he had more than one garden. And he sold at least one of his gardens and gave the money to the poor in the church. Now, you might not think that's a big thing. We're all used to having gardens. In the Roman world, only the very wealthy ever had a garden. A garden was an incredible luxury in this period of time. Most people lived in fairly restricted quarters. If you recall, I mentioned that book by a man named Rodney Stark called Cities of God, in which he details usually in a typical Roman city, you've got about 40, maybe as high as 70 or 80 people living per acre. That's per acre. And I'm quite sure you know people who have an acre for their house with gardens. I mean, that's unheard of in the Roman urban world. And thus to have more than one garden, of which you can sell one and use its proceeds for the poor in the church, indicates significant wealth. In terms of the rest of his backgrounds, we're reliant upon this document to Donatus. And what I want to begin then is to look at this document as a conversion narrative. Is really what it is. And Cyprian is probably building to some degree from the conversion narratives we find in Holy Scripture, particularly one of them, the Apostle Paul's conversion narrative. It's an important precedent for Augustine's great conversion narrative, the Confessions. So let me begin then looking at, and you'll see very clearly the rhetorician, the way in which he uses words. Even in the English, it comes through very, very powerfully. I'm going to begin at chapter 2. And in chapter 1, he's been talking about fulfilling a promise he had made to Donatus, who was an elder in the church of Carthage. On the map, you can actually see Carthage there. It's a port city. Just very quickly about Carthage. Carthage was a key Christian center. Like many of the early Christian centers, it was a large urban area on the Mediterranean, a port. And the significance of Carthage is that I think there's conclusive evidence that the first translations of the Bible into Latin were done at Carthage, not in Italy. And there's a number of reasons for that, which I won't go into at this point. But I think there's clear evidence that the Latin Bible that the early church used in Western Europe up until the late 300s, when Damasus the Bishop of Rome, commissioned Jerome to translate what we call the Vulgate, the Latin Bible was the Bible as it was translated in Carthage. So Carthage had a rich history of Christianity. By this period of time, probably about at least 50 to 100 years, depending on what one does with various documents and archaeological evidence. Now we begin then at chapter 2. Now, whatever nature and however much that is which comes into your heart from us, the poor mediocrity of my meager town produces a very sparing harvest and does not grow heavy with stalks for a copious rich deposit. He's comparing what he's going to give him to a harvest of wheat. Nevertheless, I shall approach my task as well as I can. For the subject matter of my talk is quite to my liking. In courts of justice, and he's now thinking of his own experience as a rhetorician and lawyer, in courts of justice, in public assembly, before the rostrum, let an opulent eloquence be displayed with unrestrained ambition. But when speech is concerned with the Lord God, the pure sincerity of speech depends not on the force of eloquence for the arguments in support of faith, but on facts. Therefore, receive not eloquent words, but forceful ones, not decked out with cultivated rhetoric to entice a public audience, but simple words of unvarnished truth for the proclaiming of God's mercy. And he is striving for simplicity in speech, but he has been trained in certain patterns that are they're ingrained, they're very difficult to break out of. But nonetheless, it's important to note that that in the early church, prior to the medieval period, preaching sought to be simple in its proclamation and did not seek after eloquence per se. The problem is that a number of these early preachers, men like Cyprian, men like Augustine, men like John Chrysostom, had been trained as rhetoricians, and those habits were not easily uprooted. Receive what is felt before it's learned, what is gathered not after a long study or its delay, but what is drawn in by a quickening act of divine grace. While I was lying in darkness and in the obscure night, and while ignorant of my real life, I was tossing about on the sea of a restless world, wavering and doubtful in my wandering steps, a stranger to the truth and the light. I thought it indeed difficult and hard to believe according to the character of mine at the time the divine mercy was promised for my salvation, so anyone might be born again and quickened unto a new life by the laver of the saving water. I'll come back to that in a minute. And he might put off what had been before. And although the structure of the body remained, he might change himself in soul and body. How, I said, is such a conversion possible? That the innate, which has grown hard in the corruption of natural material, or when acquired has become inveterate by the affliction of old age, should suddenly and swiftly be put aside. These things, deep and profound, have been thoroughly rooted within us. When does he learn thrift, who has become accustomed to lavish banquets and extravagant feasts? And when does he, who conspicuous in costly raiment, has shone in gold and purple, dispose himself to ordinary and simple clothing? He who has been delighted by the fasces and public honors cannot become a private and inglorious citizen. He who has been attended by crowds of clients or has been honored by a crowded assemblage of an officious throng thinks it a punishment to be alone. Of necessity, as in the past, wine bibbing ever entices with tenacious allurements. Pride puffs up, anger inflames, covetousness disturbs, cruelty stimulates, ambition delights, lust plunges into ruin. Chapter 4. This I often said to myself. For as I myself was held enlivened by the very many errors of my previous life, of which I believed that I could not divest myself, so I was disposed to give in to my clinging vices, and in my despair of better things, I indulged my sins as if now proper and belonging to me. Let me stop there before we go any further. Chapter 3 is, he's put it in the third person, but chapter 3 is definitely autobiographical. And the reason for that, I think, is the fourth line. How I said. He has come across Christians who have shared Christianity, the Christian faith with him. His first response is, there's just no way. The reason being is he feels he's too old. And his conversion is usually dated around 240 to 242 at the latest. Probably, I would say closer to 240. This is written about 243. And so he's a man in his 40s. And in Greek, both Greek and Roman thinking, you are a young man until you're 40. Now, that's why you have that statement in 1 Timothy, where Paul tells Timothy, let no man despise your youth. And Timothy at that point had to have been a man in his 30s. Paul had met him nearly 20 years before. And so let's say he was 16 to 18. He's a man in his 30s. And typically, the Greek and Roman thinking was that you were a young man until you were 30. And then maturity was in your 40s, your 50s, and by the time you were 60, you were described as an old man. And that's simply the realities of the world in which they lived. The mortality rate was generally, people lived maybe in their late 50s, early 60s. Now, he's a mature man in his mind. He's not a young man. How then can he change? How can that which is in the innate, which has grown hard in the corruption of natural material, or has acquired certain characteristics that have become inveterate, how do you suddenly put them aside? What kind of things? Well, he's used to lavish banquets and extravagant feasts. There's no indication he was married, none at all. He was single all his life. But how does he suddenly now change his entire way of spending money? He's been used to wasting money on extravagance in terms of food. How does he now shift to become thrifty? Or he was walked around in costly raiment. And when he says gold and purple, he immediately tells us that this is the class he's from. Only the senatorial class could ever wear purple. Normally what it meant was your toga would be trimmed with a strip of purple. Purple was very expensive, the color. And the reason being is purple was acquired one way. And there was a shellfish in the eastern Mediterranean that divers would have to dive for, extract the shellfish from various parts of subterranean rocks, bring them up, take out of the shellfish a little kind of the actual creature within the shellfish, about that size. And you'd put a significant number of these together, and then you'd squish them, lack of a better word, and they would secrete a purple liquid. And that was used for dyeing. By the way, this tells us something about Lydia, who was a seller of purple. She was basically catering to a fairly significant clientele, high-end clientele clothing is what she's selling. And in the book of Acts, and because the only people who were allowed to wear purple in the Roman world were those of the aristocratic class. Sometimes the toga would be trimmed also with a gold lace, which also speaks. In other words, when an individual like this walked in a town on the streets, people could tell by his clothing his status. Now, how does he put all that aside and now resort to ordinary, simple clothing? How can somebody who's been delighted by the fasces and public honors become now a private, inglorious citizen? The fasces were a bundle of rods, wooden rods, normally about the size of a man's wrist. And they would be, you'd get a group of them that you could strap together in a circle. In the middle would be an axe. And these would be carried when a judge was on his way to a public hearing. And they'd be carried in front of the judge or a lawyer. Like it's quite evident that he was. And what it indicated was two things. One is the rods were the power of corporal punishment. The axe was the power of capital punishment. Some of you may have seen some of the imagery and symbolism in fascist Italy during the time of Mussolini. Mussolini revived this image. And that's where the word fascism comes from the fasces. An attempt to go back to the glories of ancient Rome. In other words, he's going through the streets and people have seen him with the fasces in front of him, a man or two men usually, with the fasces, indicating this man has significant power. How does he give all that up and now become a private citizen? Or he has been attended by crowds of clients. Now, the Roman world was a world of, by this period of time, of patrons and clients. And all of this goes back into the 2nd century BC. And so it was an institution that had about 400 years behind it.